Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. The World Transformed is an audio production of Speculist Media. You can find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And the World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that occurs in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Oh, man. Doing unexpectedly great.
There you go. That's in keeping with our theme this week. Well, we're taking on a challenging subject this week because some would say, some would argue, perhaps, that the unexpected future is what kind of what the singularity is all about. It's kind of what we talk about all the time anyway. So what's the big deal about whether people expect what's going to happen next or not?
Well, I mean, there's things that transhuman, and then there's things that people that don't know about these things expect. And they're completely different things, aren't they?
I think that's true. You know, well, I think the basic answer is for whatever reason, we don't ever seem to understand what's going to happen. I mean, we don't have a good handle on what's coming next. And you're right, there are two different, I would say, kind of levels of consciousness of what's happening in the world now and what's pushing us towards the future. And there are those who are more acceleration aware, singularitarian types, transhumanist types, world transformed listeners, people of that ilk, who have one set of expectations. And then there's kind of the general public who perhaps have some expectations around the future, but not necessarily the same set. And then I guess there are some people who just don't think about the future all that much, and maybe they just expect everything to stay the same. So I suppose anything that happens will be we could say anything, right? We could say flying cars, right? And that would be unexpected to them. But we're not going to address that audience. Let's just be clear. We're gonna spend this evening talking about those who at least give some thought to the future. And since we did the debate last week, and I gave you the thankless task of being Mr. Buzzkill, I think I'm going to give you the more fun futures. I hope. Tonight, because mine are a little, I'm taking the futures that the acceleration aware folks aren't anticipating, and some of those are not so completely wonderful, especially not for the acceleration aware, anyhow. Whereas you, Stephen, you're taking the what the general public maybe isn't expecting.
Right, right. And, you know, I think that's changing all the time. You know, we see some of these speculative topics being covered in strange and unusual places like Forbes, you know, I mean, that's New York Times, things like that. So these topics are getting out there, but I would say by and large, there's just, you know, the general public, it just takes a while for some of these things that they would consider bizarre to really filter down. So, yeah, and so I get the fun job of really covering those that stuff, and we ought to just jump into it. What do you think?
We're going to jump in. I'll tell you what we'll do. Before we start on our lists, I just want to say a few words about why the future takes us by surprise. I think it's very instructive to give a moment's consideration of that. And I thought of I think, two or maybe three reasons. You can tell me if you can think of any others. But the first reason that the future takes us by surprise is because we expect trends to continue, and usually trends don't continue. So there's this this whole issue of people who project the future by saying, well, here's a current trend. It's this way now. Therefore, if you take the what's happening now, multiply it by 10 years, this is what it'll be like in 10 years, right? Which sometimes that's right, sometimes it's not, depending on the trend. But then you say, and we'll multiply that by 100 years, and that's what it'll be like in 100 years. And eventually you hit this point, you go, now, you know, we're outside of what's actually likely to happen. So people expect trends to continue, and trends usually don't. That's number one. Secondly, we tend to overestimate and underestimate whether certain things are likely to happen. And I've got two great thinkers who have commented on this. One is Bill Gates, who pointed out, and I think this is a very astute observation on his part, that we tend to overestimate what can happen in a year, and we tend to underestimate what can happen in 10 years. And Paul Saffo, who I believe I've talked about him before, I had the privilege of seeing him give a talk, I think at Convergence 08, so it's been 5 years ago, but a while back, but something that stuck with me. I've blogged about this a couple of times. He has a talk he gives on why technologists get it wrong twice. And I'm going to go ahead. I've got this picture, the famous Paul Saffo S-curve. Let me go ahead and I'll put that in the chat room real fast. But Saffo says that we make both mistakes when we're trying to predict the future. We both initially overestimate what's going to happen, and then we get disappointed and nothing happens. Then we think, well, nothing's going to happen, and then we underestimate what's going to happen. So there's this kind of reactive tendency to underestimate when we should be giving things credit, and to overestimate when we should be cautious. And the way Saffo has put it is, he says, we should never confuse a clear view with a short distance. And that accounts for the first half of the curve. We think, well, we can see what the outcome ought to be. We can see what the outcome that we're getting towards is. Therefore, we'll have it next week, right? Or, you know, we'll have it 2 years from now. We'll have it 6 months from now, whatever. And my corollary to that, I don't know if Saffo has ever said this, but my corollary to we should never confuse a clear view with a short distance is that we should never confuse a long road with an impossible destination. And that's what often happens further down the road. Somebody, I can't remember who it was, recently was saying that there's not much expectation anymore that real molecular nanotechnology will ever take place. Well, to me, that's probably because we've hit the underestimation side of that particular curve, right? When the idea is first introduced, when K. Eric Drexler writes his book, The Engines of Creation, there's all this enthusiasm and tremendous overestimation of what's going to happen and when. And now we've reached a point where, you know, where's my nanofog, right? We don't have all the awesome nanotechnology applications that we were hoping would be here by now. So people are starting to make the other mistake. They're starting to underestimate the capability of the technology and expect it not to occur. So we have this wonderful tendency to get things wrong twice. That's the second reason people get the future wrong. And then the third one is that we just can't or don't imagine the possibilities. And that is that whole new technologies and whole new applications of existing technologies are going to arrive. Now, it's impossible to think of all of them. And it's challenging even to get a clear picture of what some of them might be. But if we don't try to engage imaginatively, then we'll always be surprised by the future. Whereas if we put a few scenarios in place where we can say, well, I don't know for sure, but it will be something like this, then at least we begin to have an idea. So I would say those are the three reasons that the future takes us by surprise. And that was my list, but I don't know. Stephen, do you have anything to add to that?
I have a fourth. I can add a fourth.
Okay. All right.
Ray Kurzweil said that, you know, just developmentally, we're really good at linear prediction. You know, when we were on the savannah and we got a spear in our hand and we see a gazelle running by, we can predict and lead the gazelle and bring it down because that's a linear prediction.
Right.
You know, the gazelle is this far away from me. It is running at, you know, at this speed. I've got to put this much arc on it, and I have to lead it by this much, and bang, we could bring it down. But on the other hand, we just don't have that kind of exposure, at least when we were developing as a species, to a lot of exponential processes. And we're living in an exponential world now. And so we just have a tough time getting our brains around exponential development. And so I would say that's a fourth reason.
I think that's a great one. And it makes me think I should tweak that first one because there's a common fallacy there, isn't there, in our thinking, where we're extending trends. It's all kind of like thinking in linear terms rather than thinking in nonlinear or, as Kurzweil points out, specifically in exponential terms. Okay, so there you go. That's why we don't get it right. But we're going to put all those errors aside, and we're going to do our best now this evening.
We're
going to putting aside the errors we know about and not thinking about the five or six we don't, we're going to attempt to say what the unexpected future might be like. So let's you want to start? We'll take one that is going to take the world at large by surprise. Go ahead.
Okay. Manufacturing is personal in the future.
Either
from our own 3D or when necessary, if we want to manufacture something that's too large or too complex for our own 3D printers in our home, we get a printer that's in the neighborhood or in your region, print out car for you or whatever. But everything is going to be personal. There's, you know, it's on every single thing that we manufacture. Now, here's the thing. This doesn't sound all that unexpected to a lot of folks that are following this. And this is, you know, the notion of 3D printing, I mean, it's already here. In primitive form. Lots of normal, transhumanist types are beginning to get their head around 3D printing a little bit. So why am I saying it's unexpected? I say that it's unexpected because, you know, number one, I think the speed in which it will be adopted will be unexpected. It'll take everybody by surprise. And also the degree to which it changes our traditional retail, you know, storefront type world. We will wake up pretty quickly after this and realize, you know, why do we need a Walmart? What we need is actually it would be something a good deal smaller than that. So that is my first one.
Okay, personal manufacturing. Basically, we will make our own stuff. We will be the primary source for our own physical goods. Well, I've got one that sort of relates to that, so I'm going to throw that one out now. And it's a little bit of a buzzkill, okay? And this is for our transhumanist friends, because one of the things that we have observed over the last couple centuries is fantastic technological progress resulting in fantastic economic progress. Economic growth has been something that seems to go hand in hand with technological development, and technological development seems to be going out of control. It seems to be on an open-ended spiral up, and therefore we can only project that economic growth will occur along the same lines. And that's true up to some point. After that point, we will finally one day hit the wall economically, or we may. It's most likely that we will. And I refer to our friend economist Robin Hanson and his piece over on Overcoming Bias some time ago, a few years back, called This is the Dream Time. We had him on the show, and talked about this. He talks about how right now we live in this era of human history that is really prehistory. It's before the real beginning of human history, because we're, you know, most of the people who live are going to live are going to live after us, and most of human history that occurs is going to occur after we do. We're still in the very early stages, and right now we're going through this remarkable trajectory of economic progress, of technological progress, and it's not representative of what humanity has experienced through most of our history, and it's probably not representative of what we will experience later on down the road. I'm going to read it. Just a quick snippet from what Robin says. He says, given a similar freedom of fertility, most of our distant descendants will live near subsistence level. Per capita wealth has only been rising lately because income has grown faster than population. But if income only doubled every century, in a million years that would be a factor of 103,000, which seems impossible to achieve with only 10 to the 3,000th, which seems impossible to achieve with only 10 to the 70 atoms in our galaxy available by then. Yes, we've seen a remarkable demographic transition wherein richer nations have fewer kids, but we already see the contrarian subgroups grow much faster. And he also, in more recent writings, has talked about not just human reproduction, but the reproduction of simulated humans, M's. Once people become software, they'll be mass produced. To the point where we'll have them running on the infrastructure and straining that infrastructure, and everyone starts to live at the subsistence level. And he says, so unless strong central controls prevent it, over the long run, such groups will easily grow faster than the economy, making per-person income drop to near subsistence levels. And then he adds, fortunately, so that it doesn't become too big of a buzzkill, even so, they will be basically happy in such a world. So we've got that much to look forward to. But ultimately, what Robin says is that the Malthusian future, the running out of resources, is one that we hit. It's a wall that we hit, but we don't hit it anytime soon, but we do hit it eventually. So to my transhumanist friends, I would say, look out. One day, we might hit the wall economically.
That is a little bit of a buzzkill, isn't it?
Yeah.
I would say that that wall is so far above us. I guess it's a glass ceiling more than a wall, isn't it? If we look at it that way. But I would say that it's far enough above us that it's not something we really need to be worried about all that much at this point. So we have a bright future ahead. So even if we were in complete agreement with that particular author, I would say the immediate future, and I'm talking like the next few hundred years. It's pretty bright.
Well, you know, the thing is, he's talking very long term. But you can't argue with the fact that you can't double forever, right? That part makes sense. I mean, it's Glenn Reynolds always says something that can't go on forever won't. And you'll get to go, okay, well, I can see that. Okay, we can only double income so many times because ultimately the universe holds only so much. On the other hand, God, the universe holds a lot, right? So we can grow a lot between now and when we hit that wall. It requires you to adopt.
Actually,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, there is an argument there for why people would go into virtual space or into inner space or whatever you want to call it. That could be the reason why.
Yeah, and in fact, Robin argues ultimately we'll all be in virtual space, that like the whole natural universe is going to just be providing the infrastructure for all of us to be living in this virtual space, and eventually we'll even tax that, right? Possible solutions, well, we'll work down into femtospace. We'll eventually run out of space there. We'll work into other dimensions. We just won't reproduce quite so fast. I mean, you know, there are remedies. There are potential remedies to it. But that the possibility even exists, I think, is one that those of us who have an extropian mindset don't often contend with. And I think it's an interesting view to add, because we always look open-ended and up, 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 up. And I think it's interesting to say, no, not because, you know, we're going to have peak oil, you know, not because we're going to run out of, you know, it's not that this Stone Age ended because they ran out of rocks. It's not that kind of thing. It's something much farther down the road that potentially could happen. So,
yeah.
Let's Roadrunner away from that one. I've got one more buzzkill one after you give your next one. Then after that, they're not so bad.
Cool. All right. Here's the next one. How about this? It starts out sounding bad, but, you know, ultimately it might sound interesting to you. Collapse of operations in favor of ad hoc resource groups that are capable of adapting quickly. It's the ultimate coffee shop future where it's possible that you get up in the morning not knowing what project you're going to be working on or with whom, although the where will be likely to be very flexible for you, so you might have a really good idea where. Resume changes day to day automatically based on your activity, performance, skill set, acquisition, and you put your resume out there and accept or not the work is offered based on the return that is offered in exchange. That is a future I would say that 99% of the general public is not expecting.
So step me through this again. We're talking basically this is a post money kind of economy. Is that right?
Well, no. This would be a very much, money's. This is prior to there being some sort of placement for money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's say you get up in the morning and you say, I feel like really hitting it hard today. I took off the last couple of days and I'm gonna conquer the world today.
Right.
You throw your variable resume that is built all the time based on the things that you've done out on out on the internet because you completed your last project. Okay. And you're matched up with a group that's throughout the world, the best people that are available for the best price for this particular project, and the group comes together in virtual space, and y'all work on a project together. Maybe it's a one day project, maybe it's a project that takes weeks or months, but when it's complete, and it might be just a subpart of some larger project. Okay. But when it's completed, then you're done, and you go on to the next job. Put your resume out there again, and in the process, you're acquiring new skills as you do projects. You've worked with different software, perhaps. You've worked in different situations, and that beefs up your resume. So potentially, you could demand more return for the next project that you put your resume out there for.
Right, so it's the gig economy. We're all we're freelancers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like
everybody's freelance. Everybody's freelancing all the time.
Now, I think that is a real possibility. I think that the way employment is currently kind of the whole infrastructure we have for employment, the whole concept of employment that we have right now seems to be kind of in peril. I don't know if it can survive. Maybe it can. I'm not sure. Being the guy who works during the day at Jobster.com, I have an interesting perspective on this because we see what's happened with the unemployment rate and just the kind of, I don't know how else to describe it, just the kind of systematic destruction of the workforce. That's a harsh word, but that's kind of what's happening. We're losing our workforce. So the unemployment rate stays at a certain level, but actually the workforce is going away. People are giving up on being part of the workforce. So you say, well, okay, but eventually the economy picks back up again. Maybe it does, but I'm not sure that jobs ever come back. And that probably a new model emerges whereby people are part of the loop in creating economic value. And what you're describing, I think could very well be that, where people, because if you're employed at at a large company or a small company or you work for a government agency or whatever it is you do, chances are you actually do that. You probably work one project for a while, then you do another project for a while, then you do another project for a while. The jobs that where whatever you do is just repeated and repeated and repeated, those are the ones that get automated, right? I mean, it's really hard to keep human beings in those jobs. But jobs where a new project comes up, we need to take a new tack, we need to put a group together, we all need to work on it for a while, it gets done, and then the next thing comes along. That's a model that I think has some sustainability, has some viability to it. It's just going to require, enough of those that you can string together that you can make a living on it. But what you're describing is things have progressed quite a bit, and people are doing quite well in that kind of economy.
And what I'm describing is a world in which, there's no real behemoth companies anymore, but we're still doing behemoth things, all ad hoc.
Right.
And is that even possible? I think perhaps it is. It's no one person knows how to put together a pencil,
Right.
That's the old example I must have been using for years. Our free market already has a lot of ad hoc built into it. What I'm talking about is just taking it to a new level.
Yeah, in the chat room, Sally says she saw on a Diamandis lecture, a high-tech company with a mere 13 employees was sold for $1 billion. The high-tech work will be so automated, this will become normal. So definitely big changes coming to employment. And Stephen, I like the scenario that you're providing because it's got people working, and it's got a viable model that keeps everybody engaged in the economy until, as Sally predicts in the chat room, we actually just move to a post-scarcity and abundance-based economy when even gigs won't be necessary and people will just do whatever they want to do as a hobby, I suppose, because we'll be 3D printing our own stuff or however we'll be organized in that interesting future that's coming. Okay, so I've got one more buzzkill one for the transhumanist, and then I think it sort of picks up. Actually, my last one's a huge buzzkill for the transhumanist, come to think of it, but not for everybody else. So my second one also comes from Robin Hanson, and it actually came from the same article. I was rereading that, and I thought, oh, well, that's another good one, actually. Actually, the next paragraph from where I was just reading, Hanson says, our distant descendants will also likely have hit diminishing returns to discovery. By then, most everything worth knowing will be known by many. Truly new and important discoveries will be quite rare. And, the idea of running out of innovations and discoveries to be made is anathema to us. I mean, one of the things we talk about is how much more discovery is occurring today than ever has before. How we're seeing planets being discovered and treatments for diseases being discovered, new applications of existing technologies, just all kinds of exciting things that are going on that are expanding our knowledge and that are making us more capable. And if anything, we're in the golden age of innovation and discovery right now. But eventually we learn it all and we hit the wall. That's Robin's take. What do you think of that?
I have some problems with it. Maybe there's some similarity in that idea with what you were talking about eventually hitting the ceiling, but it being so far away that there's hardly any point in worrying about it at this point. Have you ever been to, like, let me give you kind of a picture of how I think innovation works. Ever been to like a candlelight service where you got one person in the front with a single lit candle? And he says, "Okay, let's everybody light your candles off everybody else." And so so you got one candle, and it starts slow at first, and then the whole auditorium is lit up like amazingly fast. Okay,
right.
And why is that? Because not only am I getting my candle lit when say I'm up front and you're in the far back still, so I get my candle lit first, right? So I don't just turn around and light one candle. I light like five candles, and then those people light like five candles each, and so it moves exponentially through the group. It's a pretty large auditorium. You still get your candle lit really quickly, Phil, because it's just moving through the auditorium very, very fast. Well, I think that's kind of the way it is with innovation. One thing leads to another, which doesn't lead to another thing. It leads to five other things.
Right,
which each lead to five other things, and it's an explosion of knowledge and innovation in all directions, I just don't see how there's going to be a limit on it anytime soon. So
yeah, Well, but again, you know, you keep saying anytime soon, and I realize you are taking the speaking to the common man here, but for singularitarians, for people who expect to be around, you know, for the next billion years or so, they got to be, you know, they don't have to worry about it, but it needs to be part of their worldview. That's that would be Robin's point anyhow. You know, if I'm making the case, I would kind of tend to agree with what you're saying, which is, okay, well, first we have to understand how everything works, which we don't yet. We've got great historical examples of people saying, you know, well, physics is completely understood, like, before Einstein gave the theory of relativity, right, which itself has had all kinds of major discoveries made after that. So first there's this business of thinking that we're anywhere near figuring everything out. And then there's this business of, well, how many combinations of different things are there once you understand, you know, even if you know all the basic facts of science, which we don't yet, in how many different ways can all that be combined to make something new? How many new ideas can there be? If I guess that probably is a finite number, but that is a huge number. That is an almost unimaginably huge number, the different ways everything could potentially be combined. So I'm kind of with you, Stephen, that we certainly don't have to worry about the end of innovations. Not for a while yet. Okay, let's keep moving. What do you got next?
Okay, next, sentient digital assistants. You know, we got a Google Glass right here on the horizon, right? It's you know, we've seen prototypes, and I believe it's rolling out for people that have like prepaid or something in the next month or two.
Really?
It's coming very quickly. Of course, we've got Siri on our iPhones, and Android devices have good voice recognition also. So you put all that together with a persistent internet connection that is connected to maybe a very powerful computer wherever you like in the world, and what you end up with, you know, with some pretty good AI, you end up with Iron Man's Jarvis, you know,
right,
with you all the time, you know. Helping you interact with the world around you in ways that are much more intelligent than we're capable of doing all by ourselves. So that's to me, it's going to be very unexpected for the average person, and fairly quickly. I would say that Google Glass and competing devices will, I think, be adopted very quickly. You know, I think there's going to be a little bit of resistance at first because, you know, maybe it looks a little goofy, you know. But I think that the shiftiness of it will overcome some of that, as well as the fact that it's, you know, version 2 and version 3 will look less and less and less goofy, to the point that it looks just like a normal pair of glasses perhaps. And then eventually, it's contact lenses that we're talking about. So that's coming. It's going to come fast, and it's going to be world rocking, the amount of, you know, the changes that it will bring.
The thing that is really intriguing about the personal assistant is that what we're talking about is this new person in your life. I think I've mentioned that my 3-year-old, she's going to turn 4 next week, my 3-year-old is very palsy with Siri. If she accidentally pushes the iPod button too long and it goes beep beep, she'll just go, oh, hi Siri. And to her, you know, with the 3-year-old's perception of everything that's going on, Siri is just like this person that we talk to from time to time. Now, I don't think of Siri that way. I think of Siri as this interesting utility that has some kind of charm to it because it has a little bit of human interaction, fake human interaction built in. But the illusion, the willing suspension of disbelief is not occurring with me. I never get in a conversation with her where I think I'm talking to somebody or where I've forgotten that she's a machine. But that will occur.
A classic Big Bang Theory episode about.
Where, yes.
Raj.
Yeah, Raj, who has all that. What has he got? He's got that personality. What do you call it? Social anxiety. He can't talk to women, but he can talk to Siri. So he has. He bonds quite closely with Siri in that one. It's hilarious. But by and large, people I don't think have done that yet, but they will.
Right.
They actually are going to have real relationships with with these personal assistants. They're going to become very real, very important people in our lives. And, you know, it's not just how much information they're going to be bringing us, how much better connected we're going to be, and that's going to be huge. That's going to be enormous. But that it's the fact that we will be doing it via this totally human relationship that that we'll be having, this relationship that we will think of in some ways as being just like the relationship that we have with our friends, with our family members. That is turning a huge corner. And I think it's a big corner that moves it's a big turn that moves us in the direction towards the singularity, I think, a real transformation of the world at that point.
Ken asked in the chat room a related question, will pets lose out to robo-pets? And I think the easy answer to that is yes, they will. Pets will be the ideal pet. You know, not version one or version two, but eventually they'll be the ideal pet. And I think at some point that, you know, we begin to ask, you know, why keep a real dog that presents, you know, real problems when you can have the perfect pet all the time? You know, now that's, you know, and then, you know, there'll be a backlash to that. You know, perfection, is that something we really should be seeking? Shouldn't we, you know, isn't that what love is all about? Perfections, whether it being in an animal or in your children or in your loved ones, I think that is a conversation that we will have as a society, and it'll be over the position of these digital assistants in our lives.
Yeah, and pets. Yeah, and other relationships that we'll be having, you know, with
exactly.
with people who perhaps aren't exactly quote unquote assistants, if you see what I'm saying. But
yeah.
You know, I think. Sally makes this point that robo-pets won't replace regular pets until they're as cute and playful as real dogs and cats. Yeah, but see, the thing is, to your point, Stephen, eventually they'll be much cuter, right?
Yeah.
You know, they'll have the big eyes without being photoshopped, right? They're, you know, and they'll do and say all the right things. It's going to be a very interesting time of sorting out what's genuine and what's really important. It's going to raise some... very interesting
discussions. I think I'm going to go the
other
way with my robo-pet. I'm going to go the other way with my robo-pet. I'm going to get Grumpy Cat robo-cat.
That's right. People have super grumpy, you know, cats. Complete
no,
psychotic
cat. My robo-cat is grumpier than Grumpy Cat, you know? So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. See, nobody would settle for just a regular, you know, standoffish cat anymore. They want the super grumpy one, right? The robo one. It's gonna blow the market out on everything. Very, very interesting, and I think very much unexpected that we'll be dealing with those kinds of issues. But I think you hit the nail on the head with that one. Okay, number three. For those of us who are thinking about acceleration, for those of us who are thinking about unexpected futures, here's one. This is I think the one of the most controversial statements I've ever made on this show. So let me just go ahead and say it. We're going to discover that the universe doesn't work anything like how we think it works. So this is kind of my counterpoint to number two, where we're going to run out of innovations and discoveries to be made. One of the reasons that I said we have a long way to go before that happens is because we still don't know how everything works. Well, it's not just that we don't know how everything works. I can't imagine a time when we should have less confidence in our physical understanding of the universe than we have now, and I'll tell you why, okay? Let me give you four words that sum it all up, okay? And those four words are dark matter, dark energy, all right? I mean, I don't know if you've thought about this, but it's really pretty interesting. You know, dark matter, we pretty much believe it exists now. It's hypothesized to exist, and it makes up 84.5% of the universe. So 84.5% of the universe is what? What are the properties of 84.5% of the universe? We have no idea, right? All we know is the impact that it has on the mass of the universe. I think that's about it. If we know much more about dark matter, I'm eager for someone in the chat room who's better read up on this than I am to let me know what it is. So we understand the properties of the 27% of the universe that we live in really well. It wouldn't be that much, would it? 16% of the universe that we live in pretty well. And the rest of it, we don't know anything about. We've never even seen it. We just kind of know it's there, dark matter. Dark energy, exact same thing. Dark energy makes up, I've got the percentage here someplace, 68.3% of the total mass energy of the universe. Okay, so once again, all the energy that we talk about when we talk about physics and all the rules of physics that we've developed from observing what we're able to observe accounts for less than 32% of the total energy in the universe. The rest of it, we don't know anything about it. We don't know what its properties are. So for that reason, I feel fairly confident in saying we've got a lot to learn about how the universe works. It's nice to feel that we've come a long way and that we've learned a lot. And I don't mean to say we haven't, because the fact that we've discovered dark matter and dark energy is a huge step forward. The fact that we know those things exist is a great leap forward. But the fact that we've discovered that the universe is mostly made of stuff that we have no idea what it is, and is mostly powered by energy that we have no idea what it is, tells me that we've got an awful lot to learn, and that we really know very little about the universe. And we're going to discover that the universe probably works a lot differently than we think it does. Right now, what we've got is these two huge placeholders making our equations work. And it seems to me that that's not a tenable position. Eventually, we're going to have a theory that includes those things, describes them, and then we'll sort of be the exception, right? Doesn't that only just sort of figure, or am I overstating the case?
I don't think so. I agree with Ken in the chat room. He says he has little doubt that our descriptions of the universe today will seem very silly in a few decades. I agree. But you got to start somewhere, And here's the thing. When Newtonian physics is not wrong, it's just an understanding of the universe at one level. And then, we get Einstein, he comes along and describes it at another level. I think that just, it won't be that Newton and Einstein, will go. It's just that there are new levels to explore.
Is right.
The way I see it. So I don't know if silly is the exact word. It's just incomplete, because it seems like our descriptions, of the universe explain a lot about the universe that we're able to see, and since it has a descriptive power, then it's likely to be somewhat close to the truth, and there's just new levels that we need to explore.
I'd say quaint.
It seems silly in its incompleteness, perhaps. Maybe that's
the word I would use is quaint, right? It's like, see how they thought back then, or how we thought back then, because we didn't have the whole picture. It'll look, it would be hard not to be a little condescending towards it, but not outright silly. Just not very close to reality. That's the bottom line. I think we've got a long way to go. Sally mentions that dark matter may just be a bunch of black holes. Might be. Although coming from Sally, I would have expected the guest to be a whole lot of dark chocolate out there that we just haven't. that we haven't found yet, but that's everybody's favorite form of dark matter. Okay, Stephen, what do you got next?
Okay, I do have one downer topic here.
Okay,
and I would say that our transhumanist friends often don't go here as often as we sometimes do on the show. Economic collapse, apocalypse, cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria.
Right.
We're talking, it could be something that just civilization ending, or it could be something that just sets us back for a long time. Maybe a regional nuclear war. India, Pakistan, Iran, Israel, North Korea, and Austin, Texas. Who knows? But it could be something like that would set us back a couple of decades at least. A regional nuclear war would just would put the economy in a spiral for a good little while, and if it spread to a larger exchange, it could be civilization ending. But and then there's things like bioengineered global pandemics, things like that. I mean, we always have to consider these as possibilities and work to avoid them. And so that would obviously be an unexpected future that would be an unhappy one for for everybody. But
it
I think it needs to be in our thinking.
Although I would say, actually, there are probably on the kind of mundane views of the future, and mundane isn't the right word, typical views of the future, the more linear and traditional views of the future, there have always been some people who entertain those, right?
Right.
I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s where nuclear holocaust was just sitting out there, you know? It was a coin toss as to whether the world was going to exist anymore. And we entertained that future quite readily, I mean, quite frequently. It was, you know, maybe as a cautionary tale, maybe as a way of preventing it from happening. Maybe that's why it was so much on our minds. But we don't see that one so much anymore. We don't think, well, there's just going to be the total global nuclear apocalypse that wipes everything out. But the kinds of things you're talking about, yeah, those could happen, right? Or, you know, we get massive solar flares, take the grid down, right? And suddenly you've got no power. And how well does the world work without
hairy,
power?
If you read the novel 1 Second After, you realize that a solar flare, a Carrington event like what happened in the 19th century could really set us back along, you know, for it could put us in the dark for a year, and
right.
it would starve a lot of people. It would be a bad deal. But anyway, those are possibilities we should protect ourselves against. We should do things to harden some of our infrastructure against EMP. We should fund Centers for Disease Control to watch for bioengineered pandemics, and obviously we need to work to avoid some sort of regional nuclear exchanges. You know,
yes.
we don't think that we're Russia and the United States are going to lob 1,500 nukes at each other anymore. We don't think of that so much, but a single nuke being sent out to destroy Israel. And it wouldn't take much more than one or two nukes, to do something like that.
Well, I'll tell you, India versus Pakistan, or Israel versus Iran, or Israel versus anybody,
yeah.
Right? A lot of these little things have a way of just turning into this huge thing, right? I mean,
right.
Even if it doesn't become the big global apocalypse. So, yeah, I agree. Those possibilities are very much with us, although probably not on people's list of things that they expect to happen. And, Stephen, I want to congratulate you because, see what you did? Out of a list of five, you had one bad one. That's 20%. So you followed the 80-20 rule. 80% of your scenarios are positive and constructive, and 20% about preventing the bad things from happening. So good work. All right. Mine are mostly buzzkill, come to think of it now. Number four for me, this one I'm not sure is as unexpected, and I won't spend as much time on it, but basically, no matter how transcendent the future gets, post-singularity or the singularity after that we can be sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers. We can become these cosmic, godlike beings. Right, merged with each other, merged with unimaginable vast machine intelligences. We can be these incredible, powerful beings leading this unimaginable existence. And you know what? The world is still going to seem pretty mundane to us. We're still going to think of our lives as being perfectly ordinary, maybe even a little boring, and they're still going to have a lot of annoyances and problems. So, unexpected future for my transhumanist friends. This is the second worst thing I'm going to have to tell them, and the worst one is coming up next. But the second worst thing I have to tell them, the world will still seem pretty much like it is right now, no matter how awesome it gets.
You know, I don't know, maybe it's just the wide-eyed kid in me, Phil, but I still get a kick out of this stuff. You know, I mean,
yeah.
As far as the stuff that... that is old hat to a lot of people. You know, the internet, cell phones. And certainly cloud computing and all this. So that appreciation in me keeps it from seeming mundane. And maybe that's something that we can develop within ourselves, an appreciation of the fact that we've come a long way, and isn't this cool? Maybe we don't need to.
In fact, I'm ready to revise it. The world will still seem mundane unless you already think the world is amazing, which personally,
yeah,
I do,
yeah,
and I think you do too, Stephen. I think that's
yeah,
a big part of what informs our view on this show.
Exactly. So since we like the world pretty, we think the world's pretty great now compared to what it was a few years ago. We're going to be even more blown away and even happier with the way things are going. Hopefully. Unless one of these,
yes, I would revise that to say the world will still seem to be pretty much the world you're living in now. I live in a super fantastic, amazing, transformative world, okay, and I expect to live in one in the future. But if you live in a mundane, boring, irritating world, yep, you know, chances are that you will transcend to a much more elaborate version of the same thing. I guess that's
that's
where that's going.
Is what we're trying to say. We, you know. You know,
cheer up,
to,
I guess, is our message.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Go to the self-help section and you know, read a book or two or something. I don't know.
There you go. Well, listen to our program.
Correct.
You know, get
yeah,
all
that's,
super
that's
fantastic.
It. Yeah, and, you know, get excited about this stuff because it's fun and interesting. Okay, I'm to number five. That,
go. What
that
do you
where
got?
We need to be. Okay.
Yeah.
We get it all.
Oh.
And here's the thing, and here's the thing that we don't ever expect, okay?
Okay.
Because, you know, we have science fiction movies, and so what science fiction movies often are is now, but with one new thing thrown in. And see
right.
how this makes the world work now that we've got one great cool thing?
Right.
You know, one of my favorite movies, Gattaca, one new thing. I mean, the world's almost exactly the same except, you know, we have engineered babies, okay?
Right, right.
It's I'm saying we get it all. Instead of one change at a time, like, you know, we get we get the personal digital assistants. We get the collapse of large corporations in favor of these ad hoc groups. We get the everything personal manufactured for us. You know, we get it all. And so how all of that interacts and how all those changes how we work that out as a culture, as a society. You know, who knows? Your guess is as good as mine, but it's, you know, it's. I think it's going to be a fantastic future. Oh, I need to throw no disease in there, too. That's something I haven't mentioned, but, you know, when we have personalized medicine and, you know, drugs manufactured just for our own problems, onboard doctors, replaceable parts, you know, that's a big deal, too. So throw all of that in the mix, and you're talking about a fantastic future, so...
You know, the idea that everything we have imagined, the good stuff, it all comes true. Kind of the bitch in society from Cory Doctorow's book, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, right, where their post-mortality, I don't like their way of getting to post-mortality, but whatever, post-mortality or post-scarcity, post-money, post-employment, you know, certainly no concept of illness or aging or disease or any of that kind of stuff. They, you know, living in a world where all the problems have been solved and all the good things that we've been striving for all this time are achieved. And you know what? It's really hard for people to take that idea in because it's almost required that you focus on one thing at a time rather than you take that holistic view. And also it just sounds almost too good to be true, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds way too good to be true, I think, for most people. But ultimately, the technologies and the social changes that would enable any one of these things are going to be drivers for all the rest of them, too. And there's no reason to expect, there's no reason to think that that one would show up in isolation. If we get one of them, there's an excellent chance that we'll get the entire set. And I agree, Stephen, it is a totally unexpected but completely wonderful future. And now I hate to blow it by giving my last one, which is actually just a little cautionary word for my transhumanist friends. Because let me just say this. Stephen, everything you just said could be right. And we might make it all happen exactly the way we want to and enjoy exactly the perfect world. Someday, the word transhumanist or singularitarian or extropian, take your pick, will be an insult. And I'm not saying they're not insults today, because some people might throw them around as, you know, disparagingly today. But there'll be insults along the lines of the way a word like, say, neoclassicist or monarchist might be insults today. Someday, the positions that we take, no matter how far-reaching they are, no matter how transcendent our vision, those are going to be the conservative position. Those are going to be the position that people go, eh, you're still thinking in those ways. It's all been replaced by something else. So no matter how far-reaching we are, no matter how on top of the unexpected we've become, we should keep that in mind, that just like our views of the physical universe are going to seem quaint and antiquated at some point in the near future, even our visionary thinking, even our most profound dreams, I think they're going to seem the same way. So all we can do is try our best, but always recognize that there's something big and something completely unexpected down the road.
Well, I don't see that as a downer. That's me. That's I find that interesting, and if anything, it's just a little bit humbling for those of us who think this way. We're today's revolutionary will be tomorrow's square, and that's kind of cool. I like that.
Yeah.
It's just something to consider. That's awesome.
That is where we're headed. All right. Well, with all of that, I think we're just in time for our music.
Absolutely. The music tonight is Howl at the Moon by Debbie.
Debbie singing Howl at the Moon. Well, Stephen, you were right. We could fit all of that into a one-hour show exactly as we needed to. So thank you for giving me that feedback at the beginning of the show. And thanks for getting the music put together. I want to tell everyone that next week we really are going to have the show on augmented reality. Colin O'Malley and Joseph Rampola are really going to be with us, and we're finally going to do that show. So I hope you'll all be with us then. Look forward to talking to you all on the next World Transformed, and until next time, live to see it.